So I will say in English the explanation so Charles can understand as well. Hi, good evening. This is a time now that we'll be receiving some questions from you, and we will do our best to avoid answering them. All the difficult ones I will pass on to Charles, that's the deal. And we will try to do it in both languages. Let's see how it will work. So questions, we invite questions about the practice if you have, questions about the teachings if you have, questions about daily life and how to do the transition to daily life and how to take it to daily life and all these kind of questions we will deal with tomorrow. We have a special session for all of that. So you might want to take a moment and reflect if you have some burning question that you did not have the chance to ask. This is your chance. We will repeat the questions for those who will not hear.
I have a question about the intermediate Vedana called neutrality. What I was thinking is maybe neutrality is not just the way that it is usually talked about, as neither nor, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but maybe there is points of neutrality, or what is called neutrality, which are gam vegam.
Both.
I mean, when two sensed feelings which are opposite to one another, like I like it a lot and almost rapidly afterwards I don't like it in an intensity. So we have these two feelings which the sum of them will be I don't know, or haven't decided, don't know what I grasp, or something like this.
So according to the text is not speaking about neutral, not speaking about neither pleasant or non-pleasant. They are not using neutral. We use neutral for maybe the sake of simplicity, but also according to Buddhist psychology, we have only one Vedana, one at one time, only a pleasant or unpleasant. There arise an experience of seeing, and it can be pleasant or unpleasant. Next instant could be pleasant or unpleasant. It cannot be at the same time. And I think it has reason. First, it is experienced very precisely in meditation. But also, if at the same time we have pleasant and unpleasant, then we become schizophrenic, because then we like it, do not like it, so we have suddenly a long line of reaction. So I think that's why they describe at one instant only one perception, and then around this perception, or thought or whatever, there is some mental factor like Vedana, one at each time, not two, so that we do not become fragmented. Now, as they go very fast, as you described, so it's possible that we may believe that there are saying that we don't know what to decide, but this is a recognition, it is a come after. But in the Vedana, which is not yet the feeling of pleasant or unpleasant or neither, at this time it does not, there is not yet recognition, it is this way or that way. So the reaction come later. But in the experiencing, there is no two at the same time. I think it's coherence, otherwise in the meditation then we start to follow, there will be many difficulties. If we said there will be two, then it's liking, not liking, then there is two chain of conditioning going in that different direction, and that will be difficult. Okay, so that's very precise.
But this is not actually what we're doing here. In a way. So
maybe you can explain her intention for her, I don't know, because she was here.
Okay. English, Hebrew, Sanskrit?
Sabava.
Sabava. What kind of language is Sabava? So the question was positive thinking. Is it part of what we're doing here, right?
Yes, yeah, so I'm also mentioning specific what Patricia said in her talk.
Yeah, so specifically, do you remember?
She was talking about thinking about how precious life is, and you know, this kind of what I consider thoughts, and I'm not sure how to handle this.
The goodness. So, as Patricia was saying in her talk, there's this image of the bird that has two wings. One wing is wisdom, and the other wing is compassion, right? Or the qualities of the heart, if you wish. It's a nice image, I find. It's complementary. It sort of goes together. Because on the one aspect, we... During the days we were learning here how to be with things as they arise, and one step would be not to push it away, not to judge it, whatever it is in the experience, but actually meet the experience as it is. And then there's a whole realm of teaching which is talking about the development, the cultivation of certain qualities. And that's another viewpoint, if you like. And it certainly has a way, has a place in the teachings, and we've been doing this as well. It's a lot about cultivating the view, which is the right view, meaning the view that is conducive to freedom. And oftentimes, because as human beings we are so caught in negativity, and in and of itself, it's very much obscuring us from being with things, with knowing things as they are, because we are caught up in our movies, in our stories, and all of that. So there's quite a few practices that we do to help the mind get free from those painful habit patterns. So I won't go so far as to call it positive psychology. First of all, I don't know much about positive psychology, so I cannot really compare, but I do know about these practices. And it's along the line of what I said, it's the cultivation of wholesome qualities that contribute to our well-being, to our freedom, in the deeper sense. And sometimes it might have similarities in it, I suppose. But for example, as you were mentioning what Patricia was saying, noticing the preciousness of life can be a very useful viewpoint, because it takes us out of our constricted little self. It's all about me and poor me, or I am so horrible, or all of that, into a much bigger view, a much bigger perspective. And something in that shift of opening the view is very beneficial. And the more we cultivate it, the more we get to taste the fruits. And the only way to know is to do it. So please, try yourself.
Beneficial towards what?
Liberation.
But isn't it the point of view, both positive or negative, they somehow, what I found, that they kind of come together. So it's still like an act of the mind. Like it can sometimes think positive thoughts, sometimes it can think negative thoughts.
Yeah.
But it's all like mind tricks in some way. So maybe the question is, how does one say kind of adopt these kind of points of views, and isn't it like some sort of mental discussion that is happening, which is kind of what we practice to ignore and put aside?
Okay. I will try to repeat. That's why I was like, "Sing the Buddha." Okay. I will try to repeat. You're saying both negative and positives are points of view, and isn't it that we're trying to practice the middle?
Somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's call it this.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. In you're right. They're both points of view, but one of them is more conducive to liberation than the other one. And they are to be understood, that they are points of view. And also, in what we're doing here is not just about being some sort of couch potato, just letting things be and, experiencing them, not being moved by them. It's rather being in life with all the movement that are in life, but being free there. It's not about pushing away the experience. And having said that, yes, a point of view that speaks about love, about compassion, about friendship, about preciousness of life. It's very interesting how some teachers would speak about it as means to realize freedom, and other teachers will speak about it as a fruit in itself. It really depends on the tradition. But you have to try hands-on practice. It's not a mind game. It's really hands-on practice to know what is actually good for you as the meditator, as a human being in this world.
Charles recommended to experience have direct experience of all experience of senses, including spoons. So I tried, and I have problem with seeing the thought as a sense experience, as the Buddha said, because there is a difference when, for instance, when I experience that I have direct experience of the wind, I can have a direct experience of hearing the sound of the wind, feeling the touch of the wind on my skin, of seeing the branches of the leaves of the, and it doesn't it's a whole experience, direct experience. But when I tried first time in this retreat to really experience directly a thought without a concept, a content of it, but as a thought, it masks all the other experiences. There can't be a direct experience. I can't experience directly a thought with other senses. So there is, in my understanding, there is a difference.
Yeah, so the question is about experience thoughts. I know that it is mentioned sometimes as a sense experience. And so if I understand well your question, if you try to experience a thought, then it is a hiding of experience. Okay, so there are a few things there. First, any experience is hiding other. Hearing is hiding seeing, seeing is hiding hearing, and so on. And they happen so fast. We believe that we see and hear and do all that at the same time. But actually, as I like to come back to the question there, if we could see, hear, and taste at the same time, so there will be liking and disliking at the same time. So again, we'll be split in five personality. So they are in succession very fast. So also is not experiencing the five sense at the same time, but very fast. But usually I don't use sense experience for the thought. I don't hear that. And I know some of my friends do that, but in the Tibetan tradition where I was trained in psychology, we don't use that as a sense. We make a distinction between what is depending on sense organ and what is depending on the mind. So we make a distinction there. Now, just to say a few more words about the thought as you try to experience it. I don't want to go too much in detail because it could take the, you know, about 10 minutes and you don't have time. But usually the difference between sensory experience and the thought is that the sensory experience is quite frank. It is what it is. We hear a sound, it is a hearing a sound. We could go a bit further, but let's stay there. And then when we see, well, then we are seeing a shape and color. So that's quite frank. The thought is very different because the thought appears one way and exists another way. It appears a person, but is not a person. It appears as a glass of water, is not a glass of water. So it is misleading. But the fact that it appears in one way and it exists in another way, this is very important because that's exactly the power of thought. That's why, as I said, to build this hall there, you don't need to bring all the elements in each one. You can sit down and draw and imagine that in the absence of what you are planning, and then you can make it. So that's the power of thought is very important. But when we want to inquire into what is a thought, then if we are lost in the contents, then it's difficult to see what it is. As I mentioned to a few people today, it's like when you drive on the road, you have the board there that said Afula. So actually you don't really look at the board, you know, how nice it is it blue or green or whatever, you just get the direction that is Afula, that information you want. But now if you work for the road department, your responsibility is to check the board. So it's not so clear there, and I think the colors is going away. So now you are looking at the board, not about what it is indicating. So a bit in the same way, when we explore with thought, we don't look at what they are telling us, what they are pointing out, but at the thought itself. And then the thought itself, when we try to be connected with, is not an external phenomena. It is just the mind appearing as a meaning. The mind has its capacity, fantastic capacity, to manifest as a meaning. And this meaning could be expressed in Hebrew, in French, in English. But the meaning is there. So when we get down to the experiencing of the meaning, then we can experience thought as a quality of presence. So it does take some practice, but it's true, if we are always misled. You know, people say, well, I try to explore thought, but this thought is gone, and I have another one. We run because we are always looking at the direction. But now I just have more way of exploring that thought. I can bring it back. It's a nice day. It's a nice day. It's a nice day, and I try to see what it is. It's a nice day. The sound has disappeared, but the meaning is there. But the meaning has no sound, no color. It is just a meaning. The mind appears a meaning. The presence appears a meaning. So, just to make a few clarifications on that. Yes?
כמו להסתכל עם העיניים שלי, כמובן עם סגורות, על הדברים שאני חווה. לא אם זו מחשבה, אבל נגיד אם זו תחושה בגוף, אני כאילו הולכת לשם ומסתכלת עליה. ואז העיניים שלי נורא מקובצות, אני כאילו מתרכזת, וזה כואב לי, אז ניסיתי להתבונן גם בזה. אבל זה ממשיך, זה פשוט ממשיך לאורך כל היום, ואני כזה, וכואב. אז אני פשוט תוהה עם...
Did you get the question at the back?
Not at all.
Okay.
I'll add the front.
So I'll try to repeat it in English. Get it to the back as well, and then I'll answer in Hebrew. So the question was, if I got you right, that when you look at your experience in the body, you actually imagine the body parts, or you go into the imagination of what you are trying to experience, and it's very tiring for you, right? Mm-hmm. And you find yourself really struggling, and you don't know whether to let it go or to continue with it, yeah?
Something like that. אני יכולה גם לענות באנגלית, אני מבינה,
פשוט. הבנתי אותך בעברית? הבנתי טוב? שחסר עוד משהו.
אני פשוט מתרכזת, והריכוז, אני כאילו מקבצת את העיניים. ואני הולכת עם הדמיון, כאילו רואה את המקום.
The concentration is a bit painful, she finds, because she follows the imagination, and it's a struggle. So I'll answer in Hebrew. קודם כל, כל מאבק. כל מאבק זה סמן כזה של רגע, 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 חשבים מסלול מחדש. קודם כל, לא משנה מה, לא משנה איפה את. בכלל זה... זה כלל אצבע ראשון, אנחנו מוצאים את עצמנו בבור, להפסיק לחפור. Okay? מוצאים את עצמנו במאבק, להפסיק את המלחמה, קודם כל. עכשיו, דבר שני לעשות זה באמת להסתכל על זה, לראות, וואו, יש פה משהו מנטלי מעניין שקורה. את רוצה לדעת מה קורה בגוף, נכון? מהן התחושות, אם את עובדת עם תשומת לב לגוף. את שמה לב שהמיינד עושה מין טריק כזה, כי הוא כמו מסתכל על הגוף, נכון? זה מוכר לכם? כן? אוקיי. ואז יש מין אפילו פער כזה, יכול להיות פער. עד כמה שאפשר, כן? קודם כל לראות את הסטראגל, את המאבק הזה, לראות את המאבק, ולנשום, להרפות אותו, להפסיק את המאבק. לראות אם את יכולה להתקרב לגוף בצורה שהיא... הרי אנחנו לא מתקרבים לגוף מפה. זה נגיד כמו שעכשיו אנחנו יושבות ומדברות, בלי שאת מסתכלת. את גורבת גרביים או לא? את יודעת את זה? כולכם יודעים בלי להציץ על כפות הרגליים. יש לכם גרביים או לא? נכון? יודעים. לא צריך להיזכר מה עשיתי היום בבוקר, היה קר, פתחתי את המגירה, לא הוצאתי, גרבתי, הורדתי. זאת ידיעה בלתי אמצעית, היא לא מתווכת על ידי הזיכרון. יש תשומת הלב מגיעה לכפות הרגליים ומתחוללת ידיעה. זה נורא פשוט. תחזרי לידיעה הפשוטה הזאת. זה ממש ממש בדיוק באותו האופן. כן? ובכל פעם שאת שמה לב שעולה קיבוץ, שיש איזשהו קיבוץ, פנים, להרפות. לשחרר, לוותר, ממש לוותר, להניח, לראות וואו, אוקיי. לפעמים יהיה מעניין לשים לב לקיבוץ עצמו. מה קורה פה? אני רוצה להצליח במשהו? אני רוצה לדעת משהו? במה אני כל כך רוצה להצליח? מה זה הדבר הזה? צ'יק, ידיעה בלתי אמצעית קורית כל הזמן אם אנחנו רק נותנות לה. והמאמץ הזה בעצם חוסם אותנו מלדעת, מפריע לנו.
המילה חמלה, compassion, נאמרה מספר פעמים בריטריט הזה. כמו כן היה הרבה חיבור של אדם וטבע. ומה שעניין אותי, מעניין אותי אם לפי הכתבים הבודהיסטיים, או לפי יותר נכון בודה עצמו, אם יש איזושהי התייחסות בין אדם ושאר בעלי החיים לגבי...
So, what's your name?
Oren.
Oren is asking if the Buddha had a reference to other living beings in terms of compassion, because you were asking about compassion in the beginning, or just in general. What's your question? About compassion. If the Buddha spoke about
אם יש איזשהו משהו שקשור לשאר בעלי החיים.
So, as far as I know, the Buddha was referring to all living beings. Yes. And the practice of friendship, unbound friendship, metta, what is referred to, M-E-T-T-A, metta, or Maitre in Sanskrit, is not just for human beings, it's for everything that is here with us, that is sharing the space with us, including animals, including nature, everything. And in the depth is the understanding that we are not really separate from it, and it's not just a nice concept. We are made out of the world, without water, without the sunlight, without tender loving care, we would not be here, all of us. And same goes for the trees and the animals. And so this is where wisdom and compassion also can meet. And it's not just one thing. Yeah. Now, I don't understand anything about anything, but I'll just be compassionate. It's really impossible. They have to meet somewhere to see, and sometimes the door is through the wisdom, and you realize, wow, there's not really a separation between me and the others. That can open the door of compassion, so to speak.
If you put the light behind, you will see when you raise your hand, because it's very dark, so that's why we choose people in front, because we see them, but behind, so it's a bit more difficult. So that we can see you, and then we can also answer. So, but okay, go with your question.
I'll ask in Hebrew, but the answer can be in English.
I'll repeat a question in English. A question about suppression, repression, denial.
Suppression.
Three Israelis, 500 translations. Let's say you meant repression, and is it okay? You say not to feel something or to repress what you're feeling actively.
I don't want to what
I don't want to experience something. Is it okay actively to push it away?
So when there are difficult experiences, It can be fear, there can be anxiety or deep sadness. So the instruction is to be with whatever is there. But sometimes our meditation is not up to the difficult task to be in touch with sadness or anxiety or fear. But at this time it is skillful not to negate it, not to say it does not exist, but not to dwell on it, so to choose something else. I mean, it could be choosing hearing, for example, because we are less in touch with the body. It could be feeling the hands on the knee, because it's not so much connected with the area which are difficult. And that's skillful. At times that's what we must do, because if we try to dwell in those very difficult situations, we are going to get out of balance and just be suffering more, and that is not very skillful. And we have to respect, not to hide the fact, I don't want to feel that. I don't want. So it's not a mistake, it's just now I choose not to be in touch, and I respect that. But still there will be time where we will need to explore that, because if it is in us, it's not just going to be away. And from what you describe, usually something that may have been here for a long time. If it is just because something happened in the morning in the kitchen, for example, usually it doesn't last for a long time, but when it's something that is for many years, we know that it is appearing and we need to touch it little by little. But so respecting, I don't feel like, that's fine. But the respecting what we feel is tricky, because one can say always, I don't feel like, and then one never face the difficulty. I had spoken in the other group in a retreat we were giving with Patricia in Brazil, and we had a friend of ours, a psychotherapist, and she came to our meditation week, and then she nearly never sat with us because she said, I respect myself. So in a sense, she respect herself to avoid herself. And that's not a good way to respect oneself. Imagine if you need to work in the morning, you phone to your boss, I'm sorry, I respect myself, I won't come. So in this sense, I think she's a good friend, but this understanding was a little bit poor. So I respect myself, I don't want to feel that. But I know it's something there that for me it is interesting to explore, but only when I am up to the task, not too fast. Okay? Not negating, not repression, but avoiding, yes, I decide to avoid that because I'm not up to the task.
Can I get closer? First of all, it's very hard to appreciate the experience of hearing tonight. If you see. You said, I think the second or third night, about you practicing a lot, for 3 months you said, and it didn't work because you were not willing, right, to expose yourself. I don't remember the words. And I really recognize with this, because I find myself not, the thoughts not only pop in, but I invite them. I'm addicted to them. I like my conversations. And I want to ask what maybe I don't remember the rest of the talk, but what is the solution to this addiction?
So the question is, one evening I spoke about treatment course that I did, and I was avoiding meeting with myself during the 3 months. And so this gentleman, he's speaking, understanding that there are a lot of thoughts, not only thoughts arising, but also he's looking for those thoughts and nourishing them. So what is the solution? So I think it's quite interesting, because that may be the case for many of us. It's not something so strange. As we sit down, and we can't do very much, we cannot open the TV or even not use our cellular phone, so we don't have many ways to escape. Thinking is a good way to escape. And I think that we also have to recognize, as you do, taking the responsibility for thinking, is not thought arising in me. You know, I don't want thought, but they are coming, I wonder why. So taking the responsibility, and while we explore sometimes, what would happen if there were no thoughts? Just questioning, what would happen if there were no thoughts? And then trying to find the answer within oneself, and sometimes one find that I rather think, because there's something that I feel is not so pleasant that I'd rather not touch. So the way we think is in order not to feel something. So when we start to take that, this being aware of that, say, okay, I think in order not to feel something, so at time we can say, what is it that I don't want to feel? So little by little we can start, yes, that's here, I don't want to feel, I can see it in this way, and slowly we get in touch. So it's not, I'm thinking a lot, I should stop and just feel, because that does not work. I keep the possibility of thinking, but I still try to look a little bit what it is that I try to avoid by thinking. So yeah, again, finding the balance, and slowly we can be in touch with what is that we don't want to feel. Now there's another aspect, I think I've done that in a few groups, but for some people, sitting motionless and with the mind not moving is very scary, very scary. And you check sometimes with the people, say, so what if there were no thought? And then they say, well, it's dead. No, it's dead. There's no thought, nothing is moving. So who would like that? So in a sense, it may have for us the fact that to stay motionless and not being active, that we can do in thinking, it has not a good meaning for us. So we can start to explore, well, what is so strange about being just sitting motionless, and then slowly to see that there may be a little bit of fear there, and then starting to touch a little bit the fear, what is so strange to be just sitting there, no danger. You understand what I mean? So there is things to explore there. I give a few possibilities, but to understand why you need to think. Not by thinking, but by feeling. So little by little that comes clear. And then keep on thinking, and at that time you check, what is it that I don't want to feel? Okay?
So, what is the approach to injustice, and is there room for protest? Yes, absolutely. One of the phrases that I love from a Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh, he says, happiness is not a private matter. And it seems that we are working on ourselves, and Patricia spoke about it yesterday, that it seems like a very egotistic thing, but actually it is not. Why? Because it never really stays here. You know, when you're happy, you want to share it. When your heart, little by little or in a big step, is cracking open, you resonate with the suffering of the world. You tremble with the suffering of the world. This is called compassion. So it's different than being suppressed under the weight of the suffering, but it's being touched by, and sometimes this is followed by an action, by the right action in the world. It's certainly not about just sitting on the cushion and having some a little bit more clarity, peacefulness, and what else? Serenity for oneself and the hell with the others. No. What we're doing here, in my view, is a political act. Because it is not just for ourselves. And the hope is that the more we work on ourselves, the more the good qualities, the wholesome qualities have been developed. It's a way of speaking, yeah? The more we are able to offer ourselves to the world that is so needed, especially in this region, not only, of course, but let's face it, Israel, Palestine, you know? Wow, there's so much dukkha, so much suffering, so much injustice. And everywhere we look around, we can see that. And it's really a question of integrity and authority, to step into our authority and to act in the world with kindness and clarity. And this is what we've been cultivating here together all those days. So absolutely yes for me.
גם מה שאת דיברת וגם מה שצרס דיבר, דיברת על רגשות ועל להבחין ברגש שנמצא. וצרס דיבר על הקטע של ההר הזה, שהוא ניסה כאילו להגיד לאנשים איך נראה, וכאילו הוא ראה את ההר ו... ומתי שעולה בי רגש, ואז, אוקיי, משהו מברלום. ואז שאני נותנת לו שם, הוא כאילו אני כבר לא... אני לא איתו באותה מידה, זה כאילו משהו... כאילו... ואז יש את החשיבות של גם להבין מה אני מרגישה.
So Noah is asking about naming our emotions, and she says that she finds that when she sometimes gives an emotion a name, like naming the emotion, it's already not there anymore, or she's not very connected to it anymore? That's what you meant? So it's no longer as intimate as it was before. Yeah. So you're asking about the naming process, or just the whole thing?
Can.
Sometimes it's very helpful to give names to things, especially when it's all like in a big mess. Like, can you imagine when we put the laundry machine? We put all kind of clothes inside and the machine done its job and it's all in a big pile together. It's really hard for each piece of cloth to be dried by itself and for us to see what is there. It's a big chunk of something. But then we see, what is what? What is this? Socks, pants, shirt, you know, we put it aside. It's a little bit like that with naming something, because sometimes when we are over flooded with emotions, we don't even know, like Norit was asking about Vedana, is it this, is it that, is it good, is it bad? It's like a whole big thing in our mind. So that can be really helpful to say, I'm angry now. What is anger? It's not just a name. It's not just a word. As I was speaking the other day, might be some hurt underneath, might be some fear underneath. I want to know there. But how do I know these emotions? Not by just the name. How do I know the feeling? How do I know the emotion? I have a body that I can refer to. How does it feel like? What kind of thought arise in my mind when I'm experiencing what I'm experiencing? So if you find that giving a name to an emotion that you have is making you feel not as intimate with your emotion, don't give it a name, but try to know it in different ways. There are other ways to know something other than naming it. As you were saying rightly, Charles was talking about the mountain and naming the mountain, and then we give it a name and then we think we know what it is. Hey, like Noah. I know Noah. Okay. No, there's so much more to Noah than just the name. So similarly, like that with everything, emotions are included. So we want to use these tools, any tool, to the extent necessary, when it's useful. And every time it's an art, that's why it's not mechanistic, it's not just a technique. It's really an art to know, to try again and again, what is helpful now, what is useful, what is beneficial.
Yeah, I'm just add a small thing here, that I was speaking about the integration, the other night, integration of emotions. But we cannot integrate something if we don't know what it is. So when I experience an emotion, if I don't know what it is, I can't even not be open to it. It's something that is disturbing me. So sometimes suddenly we can name it, but I guess before naming it, it means we are experiencing it clearly. Because we experience it clearly, we can name it, but we don't need to stay with the name. But then we know what we can be open to and integrate. I think I have quoted Bion last time, this British psychoanalyst who said that the role of the mother toward the children is to name what the children or what the child is experiencing so that he can integrate it. So in this sense, we also do that by naming. We can integrate by recognizing. So the name is a sign of recognition, but we don't cling to the name. I think I had given this example another time where, I think it was Joseph Goldstein, he thought he had, an emotion that was impatience, and then he tried for, I think, quite a few weeks, he was with that and he could see it. It was stuck, it was dead, he could not really feel it. And suddenly it appeared to him was not impatience, but was some kind of anxiety. And then as soon as he recognized it, he could integrate it. So it's not the name that was the difference, but the fact that he could name it means that at this time he recognized it for what it was, anxiety and not impatience, that he could not integrate because that was not what he was experiencing. So not clinging to the name, but the name sometimes is a sign that actually I'm in touch with it, so I know what it is. So not clinging to the name. Aimlessness, so the question is about aimlessness. I want to first to give you an example. If you want to go to sleep, you have an aim. I want to go to sleep, so you go to your room, you turn down the television, the radio, the phone, and you know, all those things, and maybe the light, and then you go to bed. But then you stop wanting to sleep, because if you say, I want to sleep, I want to sleep, I want to sleep, you will never sleep. So there's a time for the intention and the aim, and there's a time where the aim need to be dropped. So when we meditate to come here, I mean, we all came here from some distance, and then we had some aim. And this aim brought us here. So I don't know what I will do next week. Maybe I go to indoor, I don't know. It's not really usually the way it does happen. So we have an aim, and I want whatever. But now, with the practice of mindfulness, or to be present, then we have to drop the name, the aim. And for me, it was striking quite many years ago that this the absence of aim is a condition to be present and to be mindful. You cannot have an aim and to be present, because the aim is something that you are reaching out, and the present is something which is here. So if we want really to be present, mindful, then we need just to be concerned with what is it that's happening now. I have no aim. It's not, I want to observe what's happening now, because I'm just turning the aim within me, which is still a way to aim, but just open to what I'm experiencing. I may even have this aim of I want to feel what's happening in my abdomen or chest. Then I just bring my attention there and then I drop the aim. So there is for me no way to be mindful or present if we keep the aim. So there's time for aiming, you are outside and you say, now I want to go to the meditation hall for the next sitting. So there's an aim, there's an intention, and you sit down. I have not spoken about that, but you sit down and then if you say, you have a program, you know, like the washing machine. So first I do a little bit of breathing, then I will do this and that. Well, it's fine, you will be busy for 45 minutes, but you are not present. So at this time, you just drop all the intention, what's happening now? So aimlessness seems to be something so far out, but it's something very simple, and it's a necessity if we want to be present. Not something so far away or remote.
I haven't been practicing meditation a lot before I came here, and I find myself with no, it's fine, you can feel it. I quite get quite lost in the first 10 minutes, and then I just try different thought processes to bring me in. I don't know, is there like something maybe. How do you, like, at the beginning, you use thought and then maybe the aimlessness is good, but it's consciously...
Okay, so the question is about, speaking about aimlessness, so when we sit sometimes, then we sit and we are a bit lost, so it's not so easy to be in touch with what's happening.
Just to, you know, start.
To start.
Stop being.
Yes.
You know, before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I sit down and where do I start?
Yeah.
Where do I start? You know, so now, what should I do? Well, I'm not supposed to do anything. So, well, then what should I do? How do you do doing nothing?
Yeah. Do you have like a routine to just like relax or?
Yeah, there can be. Yes, of course. What we say, we take an anchor, place of anchor, could be the abdomen, the chest, could be the hand on the knees or the hearing, and that way we start, so we are not too scattered. So I start by choosing something that is present. So, body is present, I can experience it, not always easy, but I can experience this area of my hand on the knees or something like that. Then I start by that, just being not just knowing I know my hand, I own my knees, because that's over in 1 second, but to really feel it, and then that's where we start. And maybe something else arising, and then if it is strong, I stay with that. But to start with it, we take something which is here now, and that's what we're experiencing. So here now, hearing or bodily sensation. Does it answer your question? In a very simple way. Well, how do I know that I'm alive? Feel the body. I mean, there's some experience. If I will be, I don't know, in deep sleep or fainting, I will not experience anything. So I experience something that really shows that I'm alive. What is it I'm experiencing? I feel the body or hearing something. Okay.
Just to add a little bit on that, sometimes this thought, oh, how do I start? It's already creating something out of nothing. As if there is a start that you are supposed to get it right and then get on with your meditation in the right way and then you are okay. And unless you do that, you are not so much okay. There's something wrong with you, something wrong with your meditation. And actually sometimes it's really interesting to turn around on yourself, so to speak, and look at this wish, the simple wish to be okay and to do it right and to succeed in your meditation. And it's sweet, it's very sweet. It's a good intention there. And just to let this feeling and thought be there and just acknowledge, wow, this is what I'm feeling now, this is what I'm thinking right now, and it's okay. And then, of course, allow the mind to find the body, to find the breath, and just to know that you cannot go wrong here. Anything you do, everything you do in your meditation, it just, wow, every second, every moment can be a doorway for you to be present, including if it's highly unpleasant, you could be present with this as well. So it's good what you're doing.
In your talk, you talked about two different not beneficial states. One is being burdened by the experience, and the other one is being really separated from, this, from the experience. So let's say I'm aware when I can feel it, when I'm being carried away by the experience. So my question is, how do I know if I'm really being? You talked a lot about intimacy with the experience. So how do I know if I'm really intimate with the experience and not really? I'm seeing it. I'm looking at it. I think I'm experiencing, but actually I'm kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an important question. So, yeah, like I said, that we try to be intimate with experiences, not to say at a distance. And the question is, how do I know that I am intimate with the experience and not looking at it? Okay. One element is certainly through practice, where we have both experience and that appear clear. Let's imagine. Don't say it is your case, but let's imagine that I only know experience through observation. I'm more at a distance. Then I can tell you many things, but it will not make sense unless you do experience it. But the fact that you may be aware that there is possibility of watching at a distance, observing, or being more intimate. So the question may arise, and you say, I am really intimate or maybe watching, and suddenly you realize that it's something that is at a distance from the experience of the meditator. There's a meditator and then the experience. So already by this questioning that, you may be open to another possibility. Because for many people it is the only way to go about in life. But then suddenly maybe there's another way we can be more intimate, and that will open the possibility. And I still think hearing is a very good way to enter that, because when we hear, I hear the people singing there, or I hear the car or something like that, it's I am experiencing something at a distance, I am hearing the car. But when you come to the hearing, so we get interested in what is that hearing experience, and suddenly I'm very close to this very fantastic richness of the sound. I'm just that without interpretation. And I think that's a very nice door to be intimate with experience. Maybe it's the easiest door to be to understand what it is to be intimate. Then we can see I can be intimate with bodily sensation, with the body, with emotion, with many other things. That makes sense? Okay. The last question.
You mentioned tonight and also the other night the word integrate. So I was wondering exactly what you meant. Is it the same like being aware? And if not, what's the difference?
Okay. I was mentioning the other evening Freud's remark by the end of his life, saying that why difficulty keep on arising, because they need to be integrated. And that also what we experience in meditation, that everything is fine and suddenly we start to feel some difficulties, can be emotions that still arise, and often we understand that it's something that may be here for a long time, but I'm not always aware or distracted from them. So the integration there. So what we said before, first we need to recognize with type of emotion it is. So, which means already we're in touch with it, because if it's not clear, something is disturbing me, so I'm still at a distance, but as I feel it a bit more suddenly, I can say, maybe say it's anxiety or impatience or something like that. So that's the first step. But the integration is always something of the same nature. You cannot integrate a piece of metal in your stomach because, I mean, that doesn't work for most of us, you know. So in this sense, the integration of an emotion can only happen when we recognize that it is just an aspect of the mind. And through this intimacy, I really feel this sadness, this anxiety. First, it is like an object at a distance, and I say, yes, I have sadness, I have this sadness, or I have so much anger, so it's something like at a distance, but how does it feel? And then, not only in the body, but also the mind, what is an angry mind? The way for the mind to be in the world with anger, the way of the mind to be in the world with sadness, with anxiety, when we see it's just the way that the mind manifests at this time, then there is no limitation. Then at this time, we feel it is integrated and is not anymore a burden. It's just the way the mind appears at this time, and we feel there's an integration. It's like a gas, you give it more space, and you feel that it's not anymore something that is heavy or a burden, that integration. And of course, it's say in a few words, we need to explore that and try to put words on something. It does take some practice to really feel it and be able to see the emotion as an aspect of the mind. But certainly, we have to be careful. It's not something foreign to the mind. It's not something from outside. It's not a burden like my stone in the rice I can put away. It's just the way the mind appears. Okay. So I think we'll stop here for today. And I'll suggest you do walking meditation till 9 o'clock.